Expo Bomb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine atmosphere, reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
Well, bam-a-lam, sham-a-dam, and all that other stuff, it's After Rot once again. Welcome, everybody, to the show. Thanks for joining us. We're going to be talking tonight with Edward McEwen, and he's going to be talking to us about a bunch of books that he's put together and a bunch of other stuff that he's working on. Ed, how's it going?
Going very well. I've been having a good week over here. Just pretty much finished the first draft on my latest novel today, so I'm happy about that.
Awesome. How many books do you have out under your name?
Under my name right now, I'm going to have 4 in a series based on a fellow named Robert Fenaday and a particularly good-looking, genetically engineered female assassin named Shasti Rainhell. This is a series that starts with the book Was Once a Hero, goes to Fearful Symmetry, and we'll be shortly issuing Points of Departure. After that, Shasti Rainhell, who managed to live through all the mayhem, has her own book, and that one's going to be called Hidden Stars. Beyond that, I have 4 books written with a new set of characters that I plan to bring out next year. This is a fellow named Rick Tregard, who's a disgraced fighter pilot. Again, these are science fiction set far in the future, and he's sort of running a tramp freighter business, as he's very much down on his luck and in hock to the Thieves Guild. And on one expedition to an abandoned asteroid with a bunch of treasure hunters, he discovers a 50,000-year-old artificial intelligence. This machine comes back to life, calls itself Morrow. It's a combat android by a race that disappeared out of space long ago. And she and Rick kind of bond in the presence of their enemies and become friends. And the 4 books are basically the story about how they survive in the future and the nature of the relationship between them.
Cool. That sounds like fun.
Mm-hmm. It has been. My characters are always fun because they essentially write the books. All I have to do is write them down. It's a little bit like demonic possession. You know, I have a lot of people in my head and they're all demanding the use of my fingertips, but I can only type so fast.
But with much less bloodletting and shaking of the ground and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. That's more Mike Hansen's department for the Shada.
Oh, cool. And you're also an editor, and you're also doing some other stuff there that I see.
Yeah, I've worked with Mike Hansen on the Shada series, which is Mike's brainchild, a near-term apocalyptic event occurring just a few years into the future. And the stories in this shared world anthology are all linked. They're all occurring on the same day a couple of years from now, but they run the gamut from, you know, real soul-shaking horror, which has rather terrifying stories, to farce and to comedy and to everything in between. So you get the full range of fiction in writing these tales. Mike originally involved me as a writer, but he originally asked everybody for 7,500-word stories and gave people individual themes. Well, he didn't anticipate quite the response he got, so at the end of the first run here, we had 250,000 words, not all of which were actually on anything that we could use. And Mike's a visionary, and I'm kind of a nuts and bolts guy, so he needed somebody to kind of beat this into volumes and work with the writers and edit the stories. And that's where I came in. And so I ended up being the editor on the first 3 Shada anthologies, which have been issued by a variety of publishers. We originally started with a small publisher out of Texas that went under. Last one came out through Janet Morris's Perseid, and I think that, you know, their plans to bring the rest of those out and reissue some of the earlier ones through Perseid. But we shall see how all that goes. As I know from my other work, the world of small publishers is constantly in turmoil. My own publisher, Hellfire, went under last week, so I'm in the process of actually getting some of my stuff back up. Actually, all of my stuff is pretty much already back up. But, you know, small publishers come and go. You have to be flexible in these days. It's not like the old days when, you know, you had Daw and Ace and pretty much nobody else.
And I was just going to go segue onto that because you brought up small publishing. I'm a big fan of small publishers because I've been around a few of them for, like, last 5, 6, 7 years or whatever. The difference between the two, I mean, working with a big publisher, it's the whole, large process and stuff going through, and then working with small publishers, do you like the differences between? Do you feel a good fit, or how is it that you feel between the two?
I haven't had that much exposure to the large publishers. I have some friends that have been out through Fawcett and other friend named Kim Wiley, whose work, Love in Midair, came out through Fawcett. My friend Tim McLaughlin, whose book, Heart of the Old Country, was in fact made into a major motion picture called The Narrow. So I've seen them work with them. One thing I know is you pretty much lose control of the process entirely with the large publishers. With the small publisher, you have a lot more control of the process, and that's in part because they want to make you do everything. They don't have staff and they don't have money, so you end up doing a great deal of stuff either yourself or by begging and pleading and imposing on your friends to come up with things.
Yeah, the friends and family network is all part of the great grand scheme of things in small press, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and no matter what happens, they still have to admit they're related to you, so you can't get rid of you entirely.
Well, you can always, yeah, you can keep going there. So I'm playing around on your site, looking around at stuff, and I'm a speed reader, so I've read through a whole bunch of stuff on here. And when you were talking about Moro, the character from your newer series, the 50,000-year-old combat android, you got all this artwork here that all looks computer-generated. Who's doing all the artwork?
A friend named Michael Church, who is a fantastic photographer. He's mostly a glamour photographer, so he spends his days taking pictures of beautiful women in underwear.
Oh, gosh, such a hard life.
Somebody had to do it. But he's also talented at this, and it's not his thing. It was sort of something that he went into largely as a result of my begging him to do so. But he had the uncanny ability to suck out of my brain, usually without even having bothered to read the book, what my characters look like. And one of the things, I'm a huge anime fan, one of the things I wanted to do with the Moro characters was to work with somebody that actually looked like a Japanese anime character. Moro, the combat android, has a certain malleability, and to stop terrifying Rick, who is the other character, when she originally captures him on the asteroid, she kind of morphs into something that she thinks looks like a human being. She accesses his computer on his ship, but it turns out to be a game simulation she plugs into. So she has rather the look of a Japanese anime character with the tiny figure and the huge eyes. And since she'd done that one time and had trouble afterward, malfunctioned afterward, she doesn't want to change out. So I enjoy that character. She passes herself off as a human mutation. For the most part, it kind of works. But she's a very interesting character to me, and just sort of an homage to so many characters I've enjoyed over the years.
I was going to throw Ghost in the Shell into the mix on that, because that was the first thing I thought of when I saw the image.
Yeah, Ghost in the Shell, Battle Angel, Alita. That character goes all the way back in Japanese anime, and it's one that I've always enjoyed.
Cool. So, I mean, have you been watching Japanese anime from, like, the 80s and stuff like that? Did you ever watch Star Blazers?
Oh, yeah, when I was young. I started out, the first color TV my folks had was put in my bedroom after I was, when I was young and I'd suffered an illness. So I remember seeing, you know, the Batman series when it first came on in color, and then there was a series Marine Boy and Speed Racer. And I was at an age when those just looked incredibly cool to me. I mean, buzz saws on your car, a kid with a boomerang who could blow up submarines. I mean, what was not to like? And from there, I always appreciated it, and I always sort of stuck with it. I mean, I'm a big fan of the works of Shirow, Ghost in the Shell, as you say, Nausicaa from the Valley of the Wind. I love that series. There are a lot of good ones. And
did you ever watch G-Force?
I've heard of that one. I can't say I've watched that. The giant robot one in itself didn't ever do much for me. If it was just a matter of my green robot's better than your blue robot, I really needed a story or something to go with it, like the Robotech series, particularly the Macross end of it or the New Generation end of it. You know, the characters and the stories, again, made you care. Everything else worked. But if it was just, you know, about large robots banging each other in the head, that just didn't do that much for me.
Well, what I was going to say is, like, have you ever tried watching any of those shows now from back in the time when that?
Yeah, and you realize, in a lot of respects, how far they've come. Understand the critical importance of good voices. I prefer my Japanese animation in Japanese. I mean, one of the reasons I find it such an influence is because it's an access to a culture that is very, very different than ours.
Mm-hmm.
It's an entirely different way of thinking. And that helps you come up with differences in your story. So I find I draw a lot of inspiration from Japanese animation. Japanese movies, generally, I've always been sort of fascinated by the culture.
Do you ever watch any of what they call the J-horror stuff now?
Oh, you have to keep the titles.
Yeah, like Tokyo Gore Police. There's a whole crap load of them out there right now. Hell Driver was one that recently saw. But they're all basically Japanese splatter horror movies?
Not so much, no. Probably, again, more of the straight science fiction, some of the fantasy. A lot of them are short series. There was one that was actually called The Taisho Baseball Girls, which was sort of an interesting little series set in Japan in the 1920s about a group of girls forming the first girls' baseball team. There was absolutely no reason for this to be animated, except that it was probably easier to do that set. But it was a fine little story. Another one, Kids on the Slope, with the coming-of-age story, dealt a lot with American jazz being incorporated into Japanese culture. But it's basically a story of a guy falling in love with a girl. It's set in the 1960s. He's got a friend who's kind of, the school hellion, kind of the school bully, but he never, bothers him. And they all kind of form their own little jazz club. And it's an interesting story. I'm a big fan, again, as I said, of Ghost in the Shell, and that sort of high-tech, futuristic SF. I like to get out there in space and see what there is.
You gotta like Akira, then.
Yes.
Awesome movie. Love that movie. So it sounds like a lot of... that's part of the sequence of questions later in this show, but... influences are a very important thing for writers and everything, and it sounds like the Japanese culture or the Japanese pop medium seems to be a strong one. Do you have any other types of influences that keep you with the juices going in the creative mind headset?
Well, the two writers that have probably been the biggest influences on me are the classic Andre Norton.
Awesome.
Yeah, she's a fantastic writer, wide variety of books, mostly about young people trying to fit into what is often a very hostile universe to them. Orphans, people that have been wounded in wars or separated by wars, overcoming some deficit to just try and make it and to find a place of meaning and belonging in their universe. Those stories are kind of timeless. I mean, Norton was a great writer. She had a very good insight into, I think, the struggle of young people. She didn't have a great science fiction imagination. I mean, she tended to put an ER on everything, flitter, blast, on it, and it was nothing for the future. But what she got was she made you care about the people. And her Free Trader novels about a small spaceship flying the space lanes and opening up worlds of trade are just as fascinating now as I think they were when they first came out.
Yep, would tend to agree. She was a very prodigious writer.
Yes, and went in both fantasy and science fiction, her ritual. Which is sort of on the netherworld, quite between fiction, science fiction and fantasy, because there were elements of both in it. That was fine stuff. But I loved her Last Planet, Solar Queen stories particularly. The other one that is strongest recent influence would be C.J. Cherry.
Nice.
Invented what I would think of as sociological science fiction, the study of alien cultures. She does it better than probably anybody other than maybe Larry Niven, who did it with a little bit lighter touch, a little bit more fun and humor. But Larry Niven created great aliens. CJ created great cultures for them to live in.
Spectacular observations on both of them. I've read both of them and thought pretty much along the same ideas on that. Isaac Asimov, another one?
Yes, old Isaac was a great one. What was sort of interesting about him is that he gets away with something a lot of writers would get criticized for nowadays. You're reading his stories and you realize that as fascinating and interesting as it is, for the last 20 or 30 pages, you just had two heads talking. Nobody moved, nobody picked up a cup of coffee, exited a room, fell down the stairs, or did anything. Nor do you have any idea what anything in the area looks like. And that sort of stuff, I'm in a writing group with other writers, and it's something that always drives us crazy. But if you're great enough, you can get away with pretty much anything or write your way around anything if you have that vast genius that somebody like Asimov did.
Well, going with that, I mean, we're talking and I'll probably talk a lot about writing process here. Technology, for a lot of newer writers, I think, is a little difficult to grasp and try and say, okay, well, let's put the hardcore science of how do you take a tachyon particle and make it do something, what does it do, why, and all that. Now, Asimov, I knew he'd understand what it is, and if he really wanted to in the book, he could explain it, like, completely. But a lot of newer writers use the, and I've used this as well, these methodology of not actually even trying to explain it, just saying, oh, well, it's a big engine, it does this thing, and it goes like that. We don't understand, but we learn. How do you feel about taking that kind of tack either way on both?
Well, even Stephen Hawking couldn't really explain how a star drive works because there isn't one. And theoretically, FTL, well, not theoretically, on the basis of known science, FTL is impossible. We would have to find some new physics, some new way of doing things for FTL to be possible. So you sort of get a couple of givens in science fiction, you know, FTL being one of them. Best advice for anybody who doesn't like acronyms. I think you have to make it sort of inherently plausible, which is why, you know, the idea of something like an X-Wing, you know, something about the size of a modern fighter jet that's supposed to be interstellar, is kind of absurd. One thing, it doesn't even have a bathroom.
Well, we won't go in there because even the bathrooms in our stations right now are not the same as we would go here.
That's true. That's true. But I guess, well, neither one, both of them, a giant starship like the Enterprise or something of that nature, while both that and the X-Wing are equally implausible in terms of physics, it's easier to accept that a large spaceship would have the power and the life support and the room that you would need to keep people sane to go from star to star. I don't make it easy. What I use as a for my science fiction is kind of a theory that space-time is one thing, that's where we live, and then you can drop out of it and move FTL, but that the FTL universe doesn't always, you know, quite sync up with ours. So it may take you 6 months to get somewhere in the FTL universe, and depending on where in that universe, you might be away from our space-time for 6 months or 6 years. And one reason I did that is because science fiction fans are, you know, meticulous. Once C.J. Cherry found out when she did her Merchanter universe, she had spaceships moving from star to star. She actually had fans who worked out how you could go, and if between Tau Ceti and Sol took 6 months here, well, then this other star that you went to in 3 months, well, that would take 5 years. So I refuse to get pinned down by that. I used currents and different entrances to hyperspace give you different transit times. So if you come at Tau Ceti one way, it may be 4 years. If you come at another way, it may be 4 days.
Cool. So by the description of how you're talking about your universe, your world, and everything else, I'm going to guess the answer to my next question here, but I'll throw it at you anyways. Plotting or pantsing?
For me, the science fiction universe has to serve the plot. But that said, I take the minimum number of liberties with physical science. For example, you know, you see a lot of weapons that blast people and disintegrate them and so forth. It will probably never be easier to kill people than by accelerating a small bit of metal through them at high speed. So in the future, we'll probably just use more efficient guns that look rather like the ones we have now. A phaser, I think, is a very neat way to dispatch somebody, but horribly energy inefficient. Lasers will get stronger, but probably, again, won't be used for, you know, combat because they're better for burning than they are for blasting. And just imagine the amount of power, the batteries that you're going to have to carry in a weapon like that and dealing with the heat from it. So I try to be practical and to use the science that we have here, taking that minimum number of givens, like FTL. Other than that, you know, when you get to where you're getting in my universe, you are flying and you have to worry about, you know, fuel, and you have to worry about how fast you can go in atmosphere, things of that nature. I don't make interstellar travel as easy as some writers do, because then it sounds like you're just taking the 737 to Detroit. Why you would want to take a 737 to Detroit is a whole other issue.
We will go there, because Detroit's doing its own thing right now.
Poor Detroit.
Poor Detroit, yeah. So, do you When you're creating a book or a short story, do you create an entire scenario that's solid and says, I'm going to go from A to B, this is all the steps? Or do you wing it?
Okay. My writing style is best referred to as creative chaos. And a little bit of demonic possession. The characters who come to me in my head kind of seize control of my attention, and they tell me their story. They may or may not tell me it in sequence. Usually they don't. They tell me the part that excites them the most. And for me, story writing is a lot like assembling a puzzle. I have this section down here to the left, and I can see what's in there, and I put in some stuff. And then I can see something in the middle, and I put it in there. And then in the upper right corner, I can put something in there. Now, I don't have anything that's contiguously laid up. But on the other hand, even the spaces, even the holes, have a shape. So I pretty much have an idea what has to go in there. So I write the parts that emotionally appeal to me the most, because they have the greatest power at that point. And then I take the pieces and I assemble. And I can write from point A, well, I'm over here at point C, but there's got to be a B. And between A and C, obviously, these things have to happen. That gives me point B.
Gotcha. That sounds like pantsing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always fun. So, do you, which do you prefer doing, short stories or novels?
I prefer novels because I think you get a vastly greater relationship and depth with the characters. You can also create much more of the universe around it. One of the things I loved about Andre Norton is she would take time in a story about a guy, for example, the story of the Murdoch Jern, who was a jeweler in the future, and he finds this great source of energy called the Zero Stone. Well, while we're being chased by the Thieves Guild and Space Patrol, we're trying to get back this great source of power, we go on some gem buying and selling expeditions. And those are as much fun because of the places that we go to and the stuff that happens, and even what you learn about gemology, as the main adventure. Sure, she doesn't become a slave to the story arc, that it has to go forward as fast as it possibly can, so you don't feel whipped through the story. It's like being able to explore different parts of the world as opposed to running through it at full tilt. So that's the great advantage of the full format, the full novel format. I originally wasn't interested in doing short stories, and a couple people sort of prevailed on me to do them. It was also a good way to get yourself known out there, because I've got about 80 or 90 short stories that have been printed, some of them multiple times and in multiple formats. Some go to magazines and to e-zines, then out to podcasts. One of the things about podcasts and anything in the written world is they don't really share the same audience. So you're reaching a lot of people that you wouldn't have reached the other way. You know, Doonsteep is particularly good that way. Those are some fine folks over there. They do your piece up with special effects, sound effects, different voices, and essentially it's like a radio play. It's kind of like a Prairie Home Companion for science fiction.
Cool. Do you have like a favorite short story that you've done that's put out?
Well, there have been two that have led to series. You asked about one a little bit before. The Lair of the Lesbian Love Goddess.
See, I was going to come back to that one because I love that name.
Everybody does. It was just such a fun title. And, you know, I was looking for something lurid and noir to do. And I thought about some New York City detectives. Originally, this was going to be set present day, but it just didn't seem exciting enough. I thought, well, I'll set it a couple centuries hence in the spaceport of New York City. But, you know, being a cop probably hasn't changed too much in 2,000 years. You know, your feet are hot and tired, you can't wait to the end of the day, you're dealing with some idiot over here who's stoned on something. And what I did was I took a older cop, not older, I mean a guy that was, you know, full-grown adult, somebody in his
mature.
40s. Sure, exactly. He's an everyman. He's a married guy, he's got a kid, he's just gotten as a new partner this incredibly vivacious, beautiful Hispanic woman, Regina Del Mar, who is just out of the academy, very ambitious, going to be the first, youngest police captain in the New York City Port Authority Police. So she is just out there, and she's hardcore and gung-ho, and he's thinking, she's going to get me killed. And that sort of becomes the ongoing theme between the two of them. The stories are named that way because at one point they're chasing an alien bad guy through a porno theater that is playing The Lair of the Lesbian Love Goddess on it.
Well, I was going to throw, basically, based on the name and just a little brief blurb I read on it, did you read a lot of Harry Harrison's Stainless Steel Rat?
Oh, yeah, sure. that was great stuff. And I've always loved that tongue-in-cheek kind of storytelling. It especially lends itself to these noir stories because you get to have a lot of fun with the noir convention. And one of my favorite characters was actually somebody I almost killed off in the second story, but he kept getting the best lines. A transgender police informant named Freddie Bouvier, who kind of, to my mind, always looked like Elvira, Cassandra Peters. And this was a sort of a throwaway character in the first short story. I brought him back for the second short story, and he kept getting the best lines. Everybody would break up when they got to Freddie, because he's, you know, Cajun from Louisiana, you know, hooking up in New York City, and always involved in Regina and the other detective's adventures. And he just kind of kept growing on me, and eventually McManus, who's the older male detective, opens up his own private detective agency, and he's thinking, this is great, I get to hire a girl Friday, you know, somebody beautiful and, you know, exotic and mysterious to be my secretary. Only his wife ends up hiring Freddie Bouvier for him.
Well, because, you know, you never can understand what's going through the minds of your significant other in that kind of capacity.
Yeah, I think he understood pretty well.
Well, after the choice was made, it's like, okay, I got it. Cool.
I think you're alone for 12 hours a day in this place with a beautiful, exotic woman who isn't me.
Yeah, not so much. Not so much. So, in the writing process itself, do you spend a lot of time sitting in a little small cramped room? Do you? I know another writer who goes out to Starbucks and writes sitting at the tables there while he drinks his coffee. Is there a specific process you use for writing?
Always have paper and pen nearby, because anytime I'm not actually engaged in doing something else, I'll write. You know, I grab any moment that I can. I'll put some time aside for original writing. You know, if I'm being creative like I was today, I was sitting out on the back porch with a glass of wine, you know, looking over the backyard, and all of the stuff was just flowing out the fingertips. And sometimes it comes so fast and I'm seeing it on the screen for the first time. So it's almost like I'm watching the book being written as opposed to actually writing the book. But a lot of times I will take, you know, handwritten notes on a variety of pads that I've assembled during the week and sit down, and then I do my first draft from those. So again, the process is kind of a little intuitive, creative, and chaotic, but it seems to work.
Cool. And how do you get your ideas? I mean, do they just spring up out of nowhere, or do you work towards pushing ideas to you?
Usually an image comes to me. In the Robert Kennedy series, with Once a Hero, the first thing that came to me was the image of this blood-red starship sliding over a world. And I knew that the world below was dead, but I didn't know why. And I started thinking about it, and the characters started lining up. And what particularly lined up for me is I didn't want to go with, you know, a Captain Kirk-type character, you know, or a professional, or one of these, you know, rock-jawed mercenaries. I always wanted to go with a character who struck me as more real. And what would make a normal guy do some of the things he would have to do to run his own ship, to survive the things that were going to happen to him? In this case, I posited that Robert Fenaday's wife had been in the military, had been captain of her own scout ship, and had disappeared in the first major, you know, war in space for this Federation of planets that I theorized. And fanatic that he was, he just couldn't believe that the universe would dispose of somebody so important to him. So he bought his own ship, assembled the crew, and went out looking for it. And I thought, okay, well, this guy is going to be kind of a normal guy. He's not taking to this because he loves adventure, because he's a hard case, because he's professional military, because he's after booty or glory or any of that. He wants to find his wife. So the thing that would make him suffer, all the things he was going to suffer to do this, was that he loved somebody passionately and was going to go find them. And the reason that he survived in order to learn his trade, to become a privateer, is the first person that he rescues or formed a relationship with is Shasti Rainhell, my formidable female assassin, genetically engineered assassin, who is fascinated by his search for his lost wife, seeing in that emotions and a whole life that she, having been, you know, grown essentially out of a tube, never had. So she essentially keeps him alive as he masters his trade and moves from the world of being, you know, a normal person into this dark, terrifying, violent world. She's the reason he's able to make the transition. So I took a guy who wasn't the sort of guy you would normally expect to see in the center seat of such a ship, and I gave you a plausible reason he would be there.
Awesome. So it's the whole, oh, look, he grew.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as opposed to he died.
Yes.
This is an alternative.
Yes, and as opposed to, oh, well, he did stuff, and then that was it.
Right. Whether he's the rock-jawed hero, and he does this because he loves it, or glory, or money, or, you know, he's professional military like a Kirk or a Picard. This isn't a guy that wants to be doing this.
Gotcha. So he's a dude. Just doing the dude thing.
Exactly. He could be you, or he could be me. Under a set of circumstances, you know, we're willing to do things for people we love.
Or not. As the case may be, whatever it goes.
Whatever the last stage of your relationship was.
Exactly. Now, a big question for me is about the methodology of disseminating information out there and saying, hey, follow me, read my stuff. Are you a big fan of social media like Facebook and whatever all else?
Well, I think it's really where you start. You know, for one thing, there aren't that many alternatives. Facebook is a good place to start, Google, Twitter. You know, Twitter can be good because you can link up to groups and then retweet your stuff and get it out there. A ground game is important also. I do Con Carolinas every year, which is the largest SF convention in North Carolina, and I'm going to spend some more time at some of the other conventions meeting people, because it's great who you meet. I met Mike Resnick, who's the dean of science fiction. He's more awards than Isaac Asimov and Arthur Clarke together.
And a good writer, too.
Great writer, and a wonderful gentleman. You know, he and his wife, me and my wife, went out to dinner together. We had a great time, and he ended up doing an introduction for me on one of my books. He's just that sort of guy. Though that does put me in mind of another story that you were asking me earlier about where ideas come from. Mike Resnick had shot me an email and said, hey, Ed, I'd like a story of yours for Galaxy's Edge, the new magazine that he is editing. First of all, I was thrilled and honored that he thought of me. And secondly, I realized that I've sold every short story that I've written. So now I have to produce a short story really, really quick. And I got nothing in the tank. For the first time, I'm looking at a blank page going, oh my God, Mike Resnick needs a story. I got to do this quickly. What am I going to do? And my wife wanders by behind me and idly sort of mentions, oh, I heard the Space Probe Voyager is going to be an interstellar space suit. I wonder if it's lonely. And it's like, that's it! And 4 hours later, I have a short story called I Am Lonely. Or I Am Lonely. And I shoot it off to Mike. He likes it. He's happy. And it's in Galaxy's Edge number 4.
Excellent. Because when you're talking about Mike being an introductor to one of your books, I also noticed that you have Claudia Christian as an introductor to your most recent book, Fearful Symmetry.
And she is one of the nicest people you will ever have a chance to meet. Claudia was also somebody that I met at Con Carolinas, though I emailed her back and forth a couple times before, and I idly said, well, if you're going to be in Charlotte, how about, you know, we go grab dinner or something like that. I'll show you some of the local places. I never really expected that she would say yes. She said yeah, and I thought, oh, well, that's okay. But I really, again, sort of didn't expect for it to happen. So I'm there doing my spiel at Con Carolinas, which includes everything from, you know, ducking Klingons and making silly rhymes and jokes to, you know, answering questions and holding panels. When I see her striding through the hallway, and she spots me, and she goes, oh, hi, Ed. And it's like, wow, hey, Claudia Christian recognized me. I didn't expect that. She's incidentally a lot taller and slimmer than you would think, because she played Susan Ivanova on Babylon 5, who looked, you know, kind of tough and muscular. And if you meet her, she's actually a very slender woman and very, very nice. So we ended up chatting. Her husband was with her. He's a photographer. we went upstairs and grabbed a beer, and that turned into doing dinner that night, and we were just laughing and joking. And I said, well, you know, how about next time we go out to a Tuscan Italian restaurant? I'll call my wife, Shelley Kiefer. She's an artist. And, we'll all get together. We did that. We had a fantastic time. She was like the easiest person in the world to talk to. And I, met her at a con. We stayed in touch afterward. And when I was looking for somebody to do the intro to Fearful Symmetry, which is the second Fenide book, she was up for it, and I asked, on one knee, keeping my fingers and toes crossed, and she produced the intro there. And considering her involvement with Babylon 5 and science fiction generally, it was quite a coup. I was very, very grateful.
I was just going to say, it's a wonderful introduction that you've got up there, and it's it reads very strongly as, ooh, she liked it.
I think she'd like to play Shasta Rainhill.
It kind of sounds like she liked the female strong character, yeah.
Well, yeah. And you've got a girl that can run around with a 20mm tucked under one arm, what's not to like?
Precisely. And then there's always the boom.
Sooner or later, always a boom.
Always a boom. And I have to say, I always loved Babylon 5 when it came out. It was an awesome show ahead of its time, so strongly focused on just story. Great, we've got all this cool special effects, but none of it makes a hail of beans if you don't have a story with characters that you care about.
Exactly. First you have to move me, and then I will get into your story. I was a big fan of Mira Furlan, who I thought did a fantastic job with Delenn, who I often think of as Our Lady of Secrets and Shadows, because she never entirely shared the truth with anybody.
Yeah, much fun. And I don't know if you've ever read it, but Straczynski always had his 10,000-year Bible for the Babylon 5 universe. So he'd had all this information pre-Babylon 5, post-Babylon 5. They have the one episode in the series where it's like, it's a million years later. What happened? Oh, that did.
Sounds
oh,
like
okay.
A novel.
Yeah. So now we're going to segue a little away from the science fiction books and go into zombies. Do you have any opinions on zombies? Because I don't think I've seen a single note here of anything of yours zombie-related.
Ah, but I did do a story, and it's in fact the lead story in Shada Last Call. It was called I Kill Zombies, which I...
Damn it! Everybody wants to kill the zombie. What's up with that?
You have a moral issue with that.
Yes.
Well, I wrote that story, and this is a tale I was alluding to earlier. There was a piece by Johnny Perkins, who is the cover artist for Shada Last Call. It was called I Kill Zombies. It featured this really attractive brunette, scantily dressed with these big pistols, and she's blazing away at a pile of zombies that are attacking her. And I just thought it was a great image. The girl kind of looked like Gina Gershon, and originally that's who I thought it was based on. And that image stuck with me, and when Mike was after me to do a story for Shada Last Call, I decided to do a zombie story. And I wanted to have a little fun with a character that is so prevalent in science fiction, or rather really urban fantasy now. You see her on a dozen books or more. She's a scantily clad girl using a bare midriff outfit, wearing tight leather, and she's either killing werewolves while dating zombies, or killing zombies while dating vampires. She's this hard-bodied super femme who always has these emotionally ambiguous relationships. But I decided to do one of those, and her name was Raven Blackstone. The premise for this story is that Raven Blackstone is a comic book character that this 14-year-old boy has in mind, and the boy gets dragged into the Shada event, and he's sort of facing a duel in the Shada, and he's allowed to choose a second, and the second becomes his imaginary friend, this character, Raven Blackstone, this sort of super female. So that then becomes this zombie adventure that occurs, which I really sort of did it because I had a point where they run into a vegetarian zombie, and they put a big salad in front of him, so they're able to interrogate him, and then he falls down in the salad and he's going, "Grains!"
Okay.
So it was fairly satirical, but the reason I mention that story is I was very, very fascinated by Johnny Perkins' cover. I thought we could use that for the cover, but Mike said, no, I'd like to get Johnny to do an original cover. And he did it with the character of Raven Blackstone, among others. She's sort of front and center on the cover, and as drawn, she is carrying a set of 44s and some guns too.
Nice.
I wanted to let Johnny Perkins know that his painting had inspired the story, which became the lead for Shada Last Call, and a lot of good things flowed from that. And I said I wondered if he based the person he drew it on Gina Gershon. And he said, no, it was this other lady. And they said, there's a link on the bottom of the image of I Kill Zombies. And you can tell yourself that you like the painting. So I hit the link. And apparently the lady who was the inspiration for this makes her living in very naughty and strange movies.
Gotcha. We won't go farther than that because this is a family show.
Exactly. I backed out of the link very quickly and decided that she would just have to find out about it some other way.
Gotcha. So, a couple of zombies. Now, how about comic books? Are you much of a reader into the comic book world?
Not so much on the American side. I was always a big, manga fan.
Okay.
My parents were of that generation that believed that, comic books were basically written by the devil, so... we didn't really get them as children. So I never got into them. I never got into the American comic book heroes, the Spider-Man, Batman, all the rest of that. To the extent that I know those characters, I know them more through the movies nowadays.
Okay, so did you read the Americanized versions of manga or the Japanese versions of manga, back to front or front to back?
Yeah, well, either one, as long as it was in English, because in Japanese I can yell, stop thief, where's the bank, and...
What's funny about that is those are from a TV show, right?
Well, yeah, and a couple other things. I actually took a stab at learning Japanese, but unless you have a friend that speaks the language, it's kind of pointless, because you end up with a bunch of information you can't use and can't retain.
Yeah. No, the only reason I got that from the TV show bit was because I have a song, I don't remember who it is, but they use all three of those expressions as... okay, I know what those mean.
Probably because they're the first things, and God knows why those are the first things that you're taught if you're learning Japanese, because, it's a very, very ordered country with very little in the way of crime, and you just hell, police, where's stop thief, where's the bank?
Yeah. The expressions I know how to speak in any language are not suitable for this radio show, so I won't share any of them, but... I grew up in a very multicultural school, and that was the whole thing. You learned how to swear at everybody in everybody else's language first.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's nice to have a foreign language to kind of do that in, because when I lose my temper, I kind of swear in Italian, because that's the other side of my family, and no one has any idea what I'm saying.
Well, okay, so comic books is not going to be a big discussion point for us tonight. Well, that's okay. Now, a very important question. This is like pivotal. Cookies?
As in, do I like them?
Or yes.
Do I fear them on my computer?
Forget about the computer cookies. They're just really footsteps of doom in the interdimensional world of, don't worry about us. I'm talking about real cookies.
Well, Footsteps of Doom, on the other hand, is beginning to stick with me. Maybe the title of my next short story. I like all forms of cookies. I'm kind of an exercise nut because it's the only way I can keep my weight, under control. I'm a black belt in kung fu and martial arts instructor, and I also dance ballroom because I do love to eat, and cookies are very high on that list. Chocolate chip particularly.
Excellent. That is the important piece of information we need for our plan on you. That is now checkboxed. Excellent. So what do you do other than writing? Like, are you is writing a full-time gig for you? Is it the moneymaker for you?
No, because writing is a great way to starve to death, as emotionally fulfilling as it is. So, no, I have a day job. But as I did mention, I also instruct in martial arts. I've got a black belt in Lee Kai Kung Fu, and I'm now learning Lai Tung Pai Kung Fu with an outfit down here in Mint Hill. So what's really great about that was we have all these exotic Chinese weapons. My favorite is something called the Quan Dao, which is basically a pole with a giant broadsword on it.
I know that one.
Leap through the air. Oh, it's great fun. I work with a great bunch of guys who are the sort of guys that you can actually stab one, and he doesn't get too upset over it. He gets a good nickname out of it, because now he has a sword scar in his hands, and now we call him Viking. Sort of guy. In other places, they would file suit, there would be police. My office, if somebody gets stabbed, you just sort of shake it off.
Yeah, accidents happen. If it was on purpose, that's one thing.
Yeah.
If it was, oh shit, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Yeah, that's okay. Next time it happens, when I do it to you, we'll be the same way.
Exactly. Accidental contact is accidental.
Yeah.
I have, in fact, used it in my writing. At one time, I had a big fight going on Mars. This happens early and was once a hero. And I basically got two of the other instructors together, the rest of the class of about 20 people, had them get sticks and said, now try to kill us. And so the next 15 minutes, we spent sort of throwing people around, blocking sticks, and figuring out how this all worked.
So
I won't do that again.
Using that as an example, do you try and experiment with things to say, oh, that's how that would look? Okay, now I write down this.
Oh, yeah. There's very rarely anything that I do that is like physical, as in combat, that I haven't actually worked out myself, that this, in fact, this move would work if you did it. Beyond that, I have to say Mythbusters is a great help because you look at them for ways things will work and ways things don't work. And you see so much baloney, particularly out of Hollywood these days. People are conditioned to see these big explosions that slowly go out and everybody's running and ducking and dodging. And in fact, when something blows up, everybody within eyesight of it, usually within a couple hundred yards, is hit almost instantly.
Yeah. And my favorite is every single car that runs off the cliff, lands and crashes, blows up.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
you wouldn't get 100% of that if you were doing Ford Pintos going off a cliff.
Exactly. You're going to get like 1% of that, and that's going to be because somebody's gas tank ruptured. Oh, and there's a fire somewhere.
My favorite Mythbuster episode like that was one of the James Bonds. I think it was the first one with the blonde guy as James Bond. His name is escaping me right now. Anyway, he's cornered by a bunch of this African dictator's troops, and he pulls out his trusty Walther PPK, slams three rounds into an oxygen cylinder, which blows up, enveloping all the bad guys in flames.
Roger Moore.
No, it's much later than that. Daniel something.
Oh, Daniel Craig.
Yeah, him. And the Mythbuster guys showed that you couldn't do that with a Vulcan minigun with detonary rounds. It took basically something almost like a flamethrower or something of that nature to set it off. You could fire an M1 Garand through it all day and it wasn't going to set it off. It was great watching so many of the ways in which characters escape. Even recently, they had the guy from Breaking Bad. He'd whipped up some crystal or other in his laboratory, and when the bad guys had him in a room, he slams it on the floor and it blows them up and so forth. Basically, he himself is not blown up by this, by the omnidirectional blast from an explosion. And the Mythbusters guys had this. They couldn't even get a squib firecracker out of it. So
nice. I have to giggle at that because one of my favorite is the cigarette setting off a line of gasoline.
Oh yeah, that was when they thoroughly.
It's like, no, it doesn't work. Why? Because there's no combustion in a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
A match will do it. Cigarette won't.
Yeah, and even when you actually lit a trail of gas coming off of an airplane, because they did that one from Die Hard,
yep.
The C-130, even when they lit that, they showed that it barely stayed lit. It certainly didn't leap into the air, chase down the airplane, and blow it up. So.
And then there was also the one where they showed which substance would actually work and go the fastest.
Mm-hmm.
Experimenting with kerosene, gasoline, and a few other liquid flammables.
Well, and this is why I said I tried to take the minimum liberties. It's one thing to posit a new form of science. It's another one to ignore how science currently works. So, if you're going to have your spaceships changing direction rapidly in space, you kind of have to have an artificial gravity. If you want to say that you have a quantum black hole somewhere in your ships through a star drive, You have to do something so that people aren't turned into a fine red mist when they try to do a turn at, three quarters of the speed of light or something like that.
I can't remember what book or story it was or who even the author was, but they had used the most effective weapon to use in space was a ball of water.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Just drop it behind you and like, bam.
Yeah, Larry Niven said that all the time, that, all you needed was a chunk of rock accelerated to good. Or even a spear, a metal spear, say 20 feet across, if you accelerate it to a good portion of the speed of light, the impact on that is going to be fantastic. Enough, you hit a planet with it, you're going to have essentially a nuclear winter without the radiation.
Yeah, it's a good way to clean the organic life forms on a planet. Say, oh, look, natural resources, let's take it. Yes. All good, clean fun in the wide, wide world of science fiction. Brouhahaha.
Genocidal, homicidal maniacs.
Yeah! The fun stuff. Fun. So I'm also going to now switch up to, you talked about Shada, and that's a shared world universe. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure some of our listeners are familiar with Heroes in Hell. How did that end up connecting with you?
Well, that was an even stranger story. And you mentioned social media and how you publicize yourself and get out there. I was talking with somebody named Tempest Vale. At the time, I didn't realize it was, in fact, Janet Morris. I'm not sure how we kind of got hooked in. I've got about 4,000 or 5,000 people that I'm quote-unquote friends with on Facebook, and Tempest Thales ended up being one of them. And gradually, it came around to where I realized this was Janet Morris, who had done the series Heroes in Hell, mostly, I think, in the 1990s, where she took, you know, everybody from C.J. Cherry to Martin Caden, Robert Silverberg, a lot of the huge names in science fiction, and asked them to do a fantasy story in her mythical hell, in which a lot of political or historical figures ended up, and you would see their existence in hell. By and large, they kind of carried on in fashion similar to what they did in life, Julius Caesar, Napoleon, and so forth. And I was teasing her one day, and I said, Janet, the book that you missed that you should have done was Lawyers in Hell. And we start joking back and forth about it, and, you know, a couple of one-liners going back and forth, and next thing I know, she said, okay, fine, you're on, let's do it. I mean, what do you mean, let's do it? I was just joking. Next thing I know, the thing is taking off around me like a rocket. She's reaching out to people and pulling them in, and we're going to do this Lawyers in Hell thing, and we need a story for it. So I wrote one called The Pallid Angel, about an angel who was handling an appeal on somebody that was down in hell, and some adventures that occurred to him. From there, we went on to others of the in-hell, dreamers, visionaries, and so forth. We came up with a character based on, I think McCourt was his name. It was the character played by Viggo Mortensen in that story of the cowboy that rode across the Arabian Desert.
Oh, Hidalgo or whatever?
Yeah, Hidalgo. Yeah. That character, who was a notorious liar. And personally, I don't believe that you go to hell for lying, or really much of anything below genocide, but that's another whole issue. Anyway, he ends up in hell, and he's chasing some guys who were cannibalistic murderers who he had accidentally helped them, and they went on to cannibalize and murder. So he's determined to kill them again, because he's just that kind of a guy. And in the process of doing this, he's acquired a demon familiar named Smoke, who has a rather feminine character, and you just really see her as a sort of a female shape of Smoke with white patches for eyes. Sometimes she's a horse, sometimes a dragon, always an annoyance. And so it's the two of them chasing these bad guys, with a lot of the higher powers in hell wagering for and against them. And the thing that's kind of, sort of fun about Frank is Frank doesn't really regard hell as that much worse than Texas. You know, the demon is trying to torment him and says, the food down here is terrible. And he says, it's not that much worse than beans. You know, you can't have good sex down here. And it's like, well, you know, women didn't have that much use for me anyway. So he's driving the demon crazy, because it's like, you do understand you're in hell. You're supposed to be suffering. Well, you know, it's been hotter near Amarillo. So.
Well, the funny thing is, I just reread Rogues in Hell. Mm-hmm. Dreamers in Hell the other day. Finished rereading it the other day. And I just remembered reading that story again, too. It's like, I remember Smoke. That was a fun character. I liked him.
Mm-hmm.
So
they
cool.
Did more with that character.
Well, there's always room to make them even more hellish, right?
Well, there's a Pirates one that's I think coming up, and that would be sort of interesting. I picked out two sexy, gorgeous. Well, I don't know what the hell they look like. They've been dead for several hundred years, but in my mind, they're sexy, gorgeous pirates. One Asian and one Norwegian. So I just have to figure out what Frank and Smoke can be doing with them.
Being the zombie guy that I am, I have lots of thoughts in my head on that.
It's a family show, Zach.
I'm not. Well, they know what I go, my proclivities are on that sort of thing, so I just don't explore them with them. But it's getting to be about the time at the end of the show, and I just wanted to say, how present yourself? How do people find you and follow you and stalk you and do all that stuff?
Well, I can be found on Weebly.com. Which is, if you just put in Ed McEwen and put Weebly, it'll take you to my webpage, where you can find a bunch of free stuff that I whenever I make a Facebook friend, I send people a list of free stuff, a lot of podcasts and other places you can get stories of mine for free, because I always think that's a nice way to introduce yourself to folks. So you can find me on Facebook. The books you can find on Amazon. We also have them on CreateSpace, or we'll have them back shortly, because I do insist on making a paper version of everything I do. And, you know, to me, a book is a book. I have to have it in my hand. You can find the other collection of short stories that I've done, which is the Night in Charlotte stories. Those are urban fantasies set currently, and that one's on Amazon. The Lair of the Lesbian Love Goddess collection will be coming out shortly. I've collected all the stories and actually wrote a couple new ones, and that's going to come out in a first in a Kindle edition and then later in a book format later this year. So look for me at Amazon, look for me on the net.
Awesome. Again, thank you for joining us on the show. Ed, have yourself a wonderful, happy selling, book writing, all that other fun stuff.
I will, and thank you very much. This was a lot of fun, and I hope I was coherent most of the time.
Yeah, I'd say coherent was there. I think there's some of your Shada demons lurking around in some of the audio, but you know, we got the zombie thing going, and we'll just like hit them with a stick a bit.
Just remember the zombie going grains.
Okay.
Okay, Zach, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks a bunch, and that's a wrap.
A big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their picnic.